From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, we remember film director John Singleton, who died Monday at age 51. He made his debut with the semi-autobiographical film Boys in the Hood, about a group of kids growing up in South Central L.A., surrounded by drug addiction and gang violence. He was nominated for Academy Awards for directing and screenwriting. Singleton insisted he direct the film after selling the script, even though he had never directed before.
I don't think anybody else could have directed this film outside of myself.
Also, critic Soraya Nadia McDonald reviews the new memoir, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, by Damon Young. And we remember singer Joe Sullivan Lesser, who starred in Frank Lesser's Broadway show The Most Happy Fella, and then married him. After he died, she helped preserve his legacy. She died Sunday. John Singleton, the first African-American to be nominated for a Best Director Oscar, died earlier this week at age 51. He worked as a director in TV as well as film, directing episodes of Billions, American Crime Story, Empire, and Snowfall. But his first and biggest impact was in the movies, where at age 24, he earned Academy Award nominations for writing and directing the influential drama Boys in the Hood. Singleton grew up in South Central Los Angeles, and Boys in the Hood was his very personal account of life in that particular neighborhood. Singleton went to USC Film School, where he wrote the beginnings of Boys in the Hood as his student thesis. When Hollywood expressed interest in turning his screenplay into a film, Singleton insisted on directing it himself, which he did. Cuba Gooding Jr. stars as Trey Stiles, a young man trying to navigate life in South Central L.A., and the only one of his friends who lives with and is being raised by his father. Lawrence Fishburne plays his father, who in one scene takes his son and one of his son's friends to a nearby neighborhood and challenges them to take a more thoughtful and political perspective on life in the hood.
Why don't y'all take a look at that sign up there? See what it says? Cash for your home? You know what that is?
It's billboard.
What are y'all, Amos and Andy? Are you stepping and he's fetching? I'm talking about the message, what it stands for. It's called gentrification. It's what happens when the property value of a certain area is brought down. You listening?
Yeah.
They bring the property value down. They can buy the land at a lower price. Then they move all the people out, raise the property value, and sell it at a profit. Now, what we need to do is we need to keep everything in our neighborhood, everything, black. Black-owned with black money, just like the Jews, the Italians, the Mexicans, and the Koreans do.
Ain't nobody from outside bringing down the property value. It's these folks shooting each other and selling that crack rock.
Well, how you think the crack rock gets into the country? We don't own any planes. We don't own no ships. But we are not the people who are flying and floating that in here. I know every time you turn on the TV, that's what you see, black people.
Yeah.
Selling the rock,
right.
Pushing the rock,
yeah.
Pushing the rock. Yeah, I know. But that wasn't a problem as long as it was here. Wasn't a problem until it was in Iowa and it showed up on Wall Street where there are hardly any black people. Now, if you want to talk about guns, why is it that there's a gun shop on almost every corner in this community?
Why?
Tell you why. For the same reason that there's a liquor store on almost every corner in the black community. Why? They want us to kill ourselves. You go out to Beverly Hills, you don't see that. But they want us to kill ourselves. Yeah, the best way you can destroy a people, you take away their ability to reproduce themselves.
Yeah.
Who is it that's dying out here on these streets every night? Young brothers like yourselves.
Terry Gross spoke with John Singleton in 1991 when Boys in the Hood was first released.
When you sold the script for Boys in the Hood, you insisted on directing it yourself. I was wondering what the movie was like in your mind when you envisioned an assigned director doing
it. I never could envision an assigned director. That'd be like selling my mother, you know what I'm saying? that'd be like selling one of my relatives to someone. Can you imagine somebody like Alan Parker trying to direct Boys in the Hood? You know, it would probably end up Furious would be a Baptist minister, and Trey would be a choir boy, and at the end of the movie, Doughboy would sing a gospel song. So I don't think anybody else could have directed this film outside of myself.
Alan Parker is, by the way, the person who directed Mississippi Burning, among other things, for our listeners who are trying to figure out which director he is. So you thought it would be shown in things that would end up being stereotypical and generationally and locationally all wrong.
I couldn't let nobody from Iowa or, you know what I'm saying, or Idaho or even Encino direct this film. It had to be directed by somebody who lived it.
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up on Vermont and Hunter first, and in a part of South L.A. known as Inglewood, in the flight path of LAX. And it was rough, but it wasn't as rough as it is now, because, you know, the neighborhood is now seeing the after effects of the last decade of the crack, the big burgeoning crack trade, and you know, it's suffering because of that. It's now just now trying to get back up.
Do you have any friends who were killed?
A couple.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
What were the circumstances?
Well, I have a friend. One friend, his name was Robbie Stringer. He got killed because he in the mid '80s, when cocaine was made cheaper in the form of crack, you know, because that only happened in the early '80s, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started getting involved in the trade and stuff, and he got killed when he was 17. He got killed in an alley down the street from my house. And it really changed my neighborhood. Just like, you know, when one of the kids in the film gets killed, it changes everybody's life.
How did it change your life?
It was like a crux in which all these things that were happening growing up in the early '80s were like coming to fruition, and I was realizing that there was a certain system in order that was working towards, you know, my demise, you know, and to bring me down. I could just look around. I can remember being able to go to the park. And when I was a kid, and there would always be a park supervisor there. You could check out a basketball, baseball, whatever. And after certain laws were passed here in this country, in the Reagan administration and Proposition 13 here in Los Angeles County, tax money didn't go towards park supervisors or anything, and social programs. Stuff was being taken away. And I could see that, you know. So what does a park become then? The park becomes a turf. It doesn't become a recreational facility. You know, I can remember when Ronald Reagan deemed ketchup to be a vegetable. I was in sixth grade. So I'm a product of the last decade, and now I'm out for change. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the '90s, so I'm ready to deal a new hand.
No, Boys in the Hood is. A lot of it is about the importance of having a father around, a strong father,
as a
good role model, and also to kind of discipline you and teach you the difference between right and wrong.
There's a whole population of young people, black, white, whatever, that don't have a strong father figure or a strong family background, for that matter. Most people don't even talk to their kids, all right? And the deal is that it's my belief that a young boy needs a man how to teach him how to be a man. A woman cannot teach him how to do that. She can only teach him her perception of what she believes a man to be. And as a result of this, since we have a whole population of young men that don't have father figures, that don't have that direction, they're always in pursuit of their manhood. You see? They're always going to be not really in tune with themselves as young men. And throughout their lives, searching for a sense of being what a man, being a man is.
Did you have a strong father?
Yes, my father was the model for Furious.
And in the movie, the parents of the main character are separated. Your parents were separated too.
My parents never married, but they were still good parents, you know.
So who did you live with?
I lived with my mother for a certain period of time, and then when I turned 11, I went to live with my father.
It's kind of like the character in the movie.
It's exactly like the character in the movie.
Now, in the movie, the character changes because the mother kind of made a pact with the father that if discipline became a real problem with their son, that she would send him over to the father and have him live with the father. Was that what happened with you?
Yes, it was.
What were you getting into that was a warning sign to your mother?
Just, you know, fighting too much and getting into some certain things that I shouldn't have been getting into. I was on the wrong path, and I needed to be guided onto the right path, and that's why I went to live with my father.
What did your father do to lay down the law right away?
He taught me a sense of responsibility. He made me work around the house. He taught me to value myself and my culture and where I was, you know, where and it respect him, you know. And, you know, I looked up to my father like most people look up to Superman, you see.
Did you?
I'm
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, what were we saying?
I wanted to know if you ever defied your father.
Yeah, a couple of times we got into it and stuff. You know, I didn't do everything my pops told me. I wouldn't be here right now. You know, I remember my father wanted me to go into real estate. And I was like, no. He's like, real estate is the way to go. You can get your license before you finish college. I was like, no, I'm going to be a filmmaker. You know, so I don't do everything my father tells me.
Were you ever looked on by some of your friends as too much of the good kid of...
Oh, heck no.
Okay.
I've always been a psychological person.
Uh-huh.
I've always been a kind of person that could sway attitudes and sway weak-minded people into certain directions, whether or not they wanted to or not go into that direction.
This is a great trait to have as a filmmaker. How did you use it as a teenager?
Well, I mean, there are certain people I could get to do certain things that they ordinarily wouldn't do. My father always taught me to be a leader and not a follower, to work smarter and not harder. And so if you have a certain population of people that that are followers, they're easy to be led. And they're easy to be led through the power of the way you speak to them. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, my father taught me to value that. And also, I learned that a lot from comic books, too. I mean, no, you learn a lot from comic books. You read comic books, and you have certain characters who are kings and who consider themselves royalty, and certain people who command respect, like Dr. Doom and stuff. And you look at the way they speak and the way they, you know, they describe them in the stories about how they walk and everything, and you know that you know what they're about and everything. And as a kid, I internalized that, me and my little friends, you know. And so I had my little pack, just like, you know, Doughboy, Ricky, and Trey.
Boys in the Hood has gotten very good reviews. It's doing really well at the box office. How is that going to affect the next movie that you make? Do you know what that movie will be? Are you getting surprising offers?
I'm writing my next film right now.
Mm-hmm.
And my next film is going to be even more experimental. I mean, now that I've done something like this, it allows me to be more free and with my work. And it's going to be about the war between black men and women on an economic level, you know. It's a romance. it's like, you know, it's a straight up street romance, and since it deals with emotions and love, it's even more dangerous than Boys in the Hood. So maybe you'll have couples shooting each other in the theaters. No, not for real. I'm just joking. I'm wondering whether or not I'm gonna be able to get a date after this movie.
Well, John Singleton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. All right. Peace out.
John Singleton, the Oscar-nominated writer and director of Boys in the Hood, speaking to Terry Gross in 1991. He died earlier this week at age 51. After a break, Soraya Nadia McDonald reviews Damon Young's new memoir of essays called What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Mayo Clinic. When you're searching for answers that no one else has been able to find, and the most important person in your life needs the right diagnosis, you know where to go. Mayo Clinic. Find out more at mayoclinic.org/answers.
Damon Young is best known as the editor and co-founder of the blog Very Smart Brothers, where he's built a faithful readership thanks to his social commentary on race and culture. His website is now part of the black news and culture site The Root. Young calls his new book What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, a memoir in essays. Critic Zariah Nadia McDonald has this review.
Here's how you know you're a very smart brother. When you find a way to get paid and praised for your insights about race and stick it to your high school bully at the same time. In his new memoir about his experiences as a native son of Pittsburgh, Damon Young writes about a tortured relationship he had with a high school basketball teammate named James. The essay reveals so much about the performance of race, masculinity, and class. Both boys pretended to be something they weren't. James pretended to have more street cred than he actually did. Young tried desperately to hide the evidence of his family's poverty. His parents were twice served with eviction notices. Young recalls one of James's taunts. "Yo, how you gonna drop 20 a game and not have no hoes? It's like being a millionaire and no one cares." Then Young delivers a compassionate analysis of what both boys were going through. There were dozens of Jameses swaggering the halls of this suburban and solidly middle-class high school, all desperately wanting to be exactly what America would see when it saw them, he writes. All searching for a fabricated authenticity that didn't exist. What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker is a work about the many absurdities that come with living while black. In one chapter, Young explains how he feels he's missing something because he's never gotten into a fight over someone calling him the N-word. Being just black wasn't enough. I wanted, needed to be black enough to not be the guy white people asked for directions or sat with if the seat next to him on the bus was free, Young writes. So I could finally prove to myself that I had what it took to overcome it, to persevere past it. When someone finally called him the N-word, Young was so stunned that he couldn't come up with a quick response. Then he realized the folly of itching for a fight. His wishing for an N-word instigation reminded me of middle school classmates bragging about how they would fight back against the slave owner's lash or brutal cops. It takes a little more living to understand that those calculations can be more complicated than they first appear, and Young's way of illustrating this is funny and relatable. Young gets more serious in reflecting about the right way to be a man. He offers a mea culpa in a chapter called How to Make the Internet Hate You in 15 Simple Steps. Young recounts the very public education he received on sexual violence in 2012. After publishing a response to an Ebony column about who bears responsibility for rape, Young faced an immediate backlash. What's stopping us from steadfastly instilling no means no in the minds of all men and boys, and educating women on how not to put themselves in certain situations, he asked. In his book, Young explains what he learned from the experience. He realized simply going through life not assaulting or harassing women was not the same as being an ally in the fight for gender equity. Decent was and is a baseline, Young writes. You are decent, not because you do things that actually matter and actually help, but because you don't do anything. What mattered and still matters is being worthy. Worthy of the readership and the follows and shares and retweets and comments of the thousands of black women who continued to engage with and amplify my work. Young is 40 years old. With a wife, two young children, and a mortgage, he is, by all measures, a real true grown-up. But youthful uncertainty lingers in his writing. Jay-Z once remarked about the reason rappers so often grab their crotch on stage. The bravado is intended to deflect from internal insecurity. Young deploys humor and repetition the same way. He punctuates the story of his basketball bully with a few pithy lines that read like an unnecessary safety net. I'll settle for hoping that James accidentally butt-dials someone he really, 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 really doesn't want to talk to today and ends up in a 45-minute-long conversation with them, he writes, before tossing out a few more hypothetical unpleasantries. It's like a perfect SNL sketch that becomes a little bit less so because it carries on just to mine a few more cheap laughs. Young's book reads like he still has one foot in the world of blogging and another in the more literary style of essay and memoir writing. His sometimes petty, repetitive humor is what put him on the map, but it may be time to put that behind now that he's transitioning to a different stage of his career. Young has much to say that's valuable and important about race, about power, and about how to be a modern man.
Soraya Nadia McDonald is the culture critic for The Undefeated. She reviewed What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker by Damon Young. After a break, Maureen Corrigan looks at two other books, and we listen back to an interview with Joe Sullivan Lesser, the musical comedy actress who died Sunday at age 91. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor OnStar. Think about being alone when something unexpected happens, like a car crash. What if there is a way for someone to help you? OnStar has automatic crash response. When a crash is detected, an emergency certified advisor can automatically connect to your vehicle to get you help. OnStar, be safe out there. Certified by International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. OnStar links to emergency services. Not all vehicles may transmit all crash data. See OnStar.com for details.
Weight can be a thorny topic, but Life Kit is here to give you the facts.
The scale measures the gravitational pull of the Earth at a given moment in time. The scale doesn't measure health, happiness, success, effort, or self-worth.
Here at Life Kit, we're rethinking weight. Find it wherever you're listening or at npr.org/lifekit.
Joe Sullivan Lesser, the musical comedy star who was featured in the first New York production of the Threepenny Opera and originated the role of Rosabella in The Most Happy Fella, died Sunday. She was 91 years old. When she was cast in The Most Happy Fella, she met and eventually married the show's composer, Frank Lesser, who wrote such other musicals as Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. He died in 1969. Terry Gross spoke with Joe Sullivan Lesser in 2006 when The Most Happy Fella was being revived by the New York City Opera. The Most Happy Fella is about as different from Guys and Dolls as a musical can get. Guys and Dolls is streetwise and slangy, a jazz-inspired comedy about gamblers. The Most Happy Fella, on the other hand, is inspired by Italian opera. It's set in the Depression at a California vineyard where a lonely waitress becomes the mail-order bride of an older man. She betrays him, only to later fall truly in love with him. Here's Joe Sullivan Lesser from the original cast recording.
Now I'm lucky that somebody somewhere wants me and needs me. That's very wonderful to know. Somebody lonely wants me to care, wants me of all people to notice him there. Well, I want to be wanted, need to be needed, and I'll admit I'm all aglow.
That was Joe Sullivan Lesser from the original cast recording of The Most Happy Fella. She got the part while she was performing in the first New York production of the Three Penny Opera with Lotta Lenya.
The producers saw me, and then they dragged Frank down to see me. And then after that, I auditioned about 20 times. And in those days, there were about three of us that sang all the soprano roles. You know, in those days, the sopranos, the leading ladies, were little blondes. And one was Barbara Cook, and one was Florence Henderson, and one was myself. So we all auditioned, but I guess I was more Southern and sounded more like a waitress than the other two, so I got the part.
What did you do each of those 20 times? I mean, were the auditions different from time to time?
I would sing the same song some of the time, but he would have you do something that absolutely drove you nuts. He would have you sing Happy Birthday to You, and he would have you sing it higher and higher and higher and higher. We would have to go, Happy Birthday to you, Happy Birthday to you, Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday, till you almost hit the ceiling.
So what was he like to work with that first time before you were married to him? Did he give you a lot of direction about how he wanted the music sung or what he was thinking when he wrote it?
Frank gave everybody a lot of direction about how he wanted the music sung. The words were very important to Frank, too. He loved the words because when he wrote a piece, he always wrote the words first. And then he would write a melody. And he used to say to me, I don't pay any attention to this melody. It may not be the right one. It's just a dummy melody. Just listen to the words.
Now, it was during the making of The Most Happy Fellow that you and your husband fell in love. I mean, you met through the show. I imagine that's when you fell in love because you got married afterwards.
Yeah, we did, yes.
So at what point did you realize that you were more than his star and he was more than your director?
Well, you just couldn't work with Frank and not sort of fall in love with him. He was enchanting. I admired his work greatly. He was witty. He was just a wonderful, wonderful human being to be with. And both of us were not exactly happy in the arrangements we had. Both of us were married. And so we just sort of got together after that.
Did you try to keep it hidden during the show?
Well, of course. Everyone, naturally. But there was a spark there, I think. People sort of knew it. And we were married 2 years after the show, after I left the show in 1960. I have to think of the year. My. It was wonderful to be married to a composer. I didn't sing after that for 17 years because he didn't want me to sing. He wanted me to be with him and go where he went. And we had two beautiful children, two girls. But it worked out fine. I was very happy.
Well, how did you feel about giving up performing? You have such a beautiful voice.
Well, thank you very much. I frankly didn't even think about it. I was very busy going to all the shows with them and listening to what was going on and seeing how things were working out and taking care of two children. And Frank was a handful, I have to say.
In what sense?
He demanded a lot of attention. He wanted to make sure we went on trips and listen to this. He wanted me to listen to that piece or listen to this piece and learn that piece for him and see if it sounded right. And I played the piano and I would play parts of it for the piano with him to see if it was right. And he was a handful. He used to go to bed at 12 o'clock at night and around 12 and get up at 4 in the morning. And from 4 in the morning till 8 o'clock in the morning, he would write and on a silent piano, thankfully. And that's because the telephone couldn't bother him. He could write and compose and be completely clear about that. He would also get in the car, and you would drive him around, and he would write in the car because the telephone couldn't get to him, too, at the same time. And then in the morning when I would get up, 7:30 or whatever, he would be having a martini, and I would be having a cup of coffee. Because he'd been up for 4 hours, so he was having lunch and I was having breakfast. It was kind of a funny arrangement.
Frank Lesser was a kind of interesting singer himself. He recorded some demos that were put together on CD, and I really love that recording. So I thought we could pause here and listen to one of them. I thought we'd hear him singing something he wrote for Guys and Dolls.
I put that we put that album together to make sure that he sang. I thought he sang terrific. I mean, let's face it, he didn't have a very beautiful voice, but he certainly knew how to put a lyric over. I mean, you could see how important the lyrics were to him. And I think it shows on this album. I think it's great fun to listen to.
No, me too. Well, let's hear it. This is Frank Lesser singing one of his songs from Guys and Dolls, I'll Know.
I'll know when my love comes along. I'll know then and there. I'll know at the sight of her face. How I care, how I care, how I care. And I'll stop and I'll stare. And I'll know long before we can speak. I'll know in my heart. I'll know and I won't ever ask. Am I right? Am I wise? Am I smart? But I'll stop and I'll stare at that face in the throng. Yes, I know when my love comes along.
You know, we heard Frank Lesser singing one of his songs. What was his attitude towards singers and musicians who took liberties with either his lyrics or the music? And I'm talking about on their own records. I'm not talking about when they were appearing in a production of one of his shows.
I don't think he cared when they were on a record. I know that he used to say to me, oh, let them do that. That song is so famous, it doesn't make any difference. That would happen often. But if you did decide that you were going to do something and change the way you sang or whatever, his rhythm or whatever he wrote in a show, then there was a lot of trouble. And in How to Succeed, he had such a fight with Rudy Valley. You know, Rudy Valley had been singing for many, many years and said, listen, I don't need anybody to tell me how to sing a song. Well, Frank said, well, you're going to sing my song this way. They almost came to blows. But the fact was that Frank quit the show. When he came home, I said to him, I think you've gone a little far this time, Frank, for God's sakes. But he quit the show, and they had to beg him and cajole him to come back, and of course he did. And then when they made the movie of Guys and Dolls, Frank Sinatra would not sing the songs the way Frank wanted him to. And Frank wrote him a great song called Adelaide. And Sinatra and he never spoke after that. They had such a fight that they never spoke after that movie.
What exactly was the fight about?
Because Sinatra would not sing Frank's songs the way he wanted him to.
Melodically or lyrically?
He was going to croon him more than that, and Frank didn't like it and didn't think it suited the part.
Oh.
And well, I think he was right.
So who won in the movie of Guys and Dolls? Was it Sinatra or Frank Lesser?
I think that Sinatra sang it the way he wanted to.
No, your husband, Frank Lesser, died at, what was he, like 59?
59 years old, yes.
Of lung cancer after you were married about 10 years.
Yes, we were.
And he left to you, what, his publishing company, which was publishing rights to all of his songs?
Yes, yes. He left to me his publishing company. He was a superb businessman.
So what were some of the difficult decisions you had to make about rights to his songs and rights to his musicals?
Well, I remember that he told me, first of all, we never allowed anyone to sing Adelaide's Lament on television. And Frank told me that don't let them sing the big songs too much. Save them for big moments because they'll ruin it. So I keep Luck Be a Lady. Every week, two or three times, somebody calls and wants to do Luck Be a Lady. And I don't let them do it. Very, very seldom do I.
Before you did Frank Lesser's The Most Happy Fella, you were off-Broadway in the original New York production of the Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht musical The Three Penny Opera. And this was the production that Mark Blitzstein wrote the translation for. It's a really famous production.
Ran for 5 years.
Yeah, and the cast recording is still around and still, of course, wonderful. I want to play your duet with Bea Arthur, who eventually became known for her TV role as Maud and then for her role on The Golden Girls. This is called the Jealousy Duet because you're both...
After Mack the Knife, of
exactly,
course.
Exactly. So we're going to pick this up in the part where you're singing the main part because it kind of alternates between the two of you. So here it is from the Three Penny Opera, my guest Joe Sullivan Lesser and Bea Arthur.
Yes, they call me Beauty of the Town. See my legs and say, now those are pretty. I'm glad you're glad to admire beauty. Now the tree must dangle in the city.
Go paddle your wares somewhere else.
I knew I would make a big impression on my Mackie.
Oh, did you?
You'll be pleased to know I've met his Jackie.
Have you?
Well, you kind of make me laugh.
Now I kind of make you laugh.
Who would want a big giraffe?
Who would want what big giraffe?
Ah, you are so pitiful, imagining you're beautiful.
Bet you wouldn't ask him.
Certainly I'll ask him.
Go on then, ask him.
You better ask him.
A big, complete girl.
Him leave me falling, sweet girl.
Asinine.
That's my guest, Joe Sullivan Lesser, along with Bea Arthur from the Three Penny Opera production with the original New York production with lyrics translated by Mark Blitzstein. Now, one of the amazing things about this production is that Kurt Weill's widow, Lottie Lenya, was in it. After you married Frank Lesser, did you kind of think back to your experiences with Lottie Lenya and how what her relationship was like with her husband and his work? I know he had already passed away by the time you were in the Three Penny Opera, but still... She must have spoken to you about what it had been like to work with her husband.
She spoke very little about that. I know that I stood in the wings and watched her all the time because she was superb. The woman was absolutely superb. And a few years, I would started to sing Frank's songs by then in clubs at the ballroom and in hotels and concerts, etc. And I would never talk about him. I just didn't feel like, oh, I could say anything, you know, like, oh, he always liked to wear a blue shirt. And I went to hear Lottie. She talked all about Kurt Weill, and she told many stories about him, how he worked and what kind of a person he was and their relationship. And I was fascinated. It was so interesting. And I said, well, I'm going to do that from now on. So I started talking all about Frank, about how he would work and how he'd get up at, you know, at 12 o'clock at night and his martini in the morning, and that he always loved blue shirts and always wore them. And he would write notes. He drew, I must say, beautifully. And he would write me a note and make it like an airplane and throw it through the door, and they'd say, are you ready to go out now? How about it's 8 o'clock? I have 300 of his drawings that are wonderful, musing. He had great, great wit drawings. And I talked to him about his drawings and did some songs that weren't famous and all of that sort of thing. And Lenya's the one that helped me do that because I saw how interesting it was to know those things.
Well, I'm glad you've kept alive your memories of him and have shared them. And thank you for sharing some of them with us today. Thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you so much for asking me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Musical comedy star Joe Sullivan Lesser speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. Joe Sullivan Lesser starred in the original 1956 Broadway production of The Most Happy Fella, where she met and married the show's composer and lyricist, Frank Lesser. He died in 1969. Joe Sullivan Lesser died Sunday at age 91. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan suggests two new books to add to your summer reading list. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Wix.com. With Wix, you can create your very own professional website. Choose a designer-made template or let Wix Artificial Design Intelligence build your site for you. With advanced design features, you can tell your story exactly the way you want. It's easy to start a blog, an online store, or create an event. And you can share it all on social media in a click. Get started now by going to Wix.com. That's Wix.com/freshair to get 10% off.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus. They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's never too early to get a jump on summer reading. She has two good books she wants to recommend.
Save the experimental fiction for fall. Summertime reading is all about storytelling. As a preseason teaser, I'm recommending two new, very different novels that tell the kind of stories readers can get lost in. Sarah Blake writes in the historical fiction tradition of a Herman Woke. In her 2009 bestseller, The Postmistress, and her latest doorstopper, The Guest Book, multifamily dramas intersect with the larger forces of war and social upheaval. The Guest Book opens with a domestic shocker. The year is 1935. The place is New York City. Kitty Milton and her husband Ogden are insulated from the anxieties of the Great Depression by a rock-solid fortification of old money. One afternoon, Kitty enters her family's hushed Upper East Side apartment after a pleasant interlude at the Philharmonic. She flings open a window in the master bedroom. Remember, this is the pre-air conditioning era, and proceeds to freshen up. When Kitty looks in her mirror, she sees that her two sons have entered the room, and the rowdy older one, Nettie, age 5, has climbed onto the window seat, stood up, and is about to toss his teddy bear out onto the street 14 stories below. Kitty calls his name, and Nettie falls out the open window. That moment warps the fate of the Milton family for generations. But in the immediate aftermath, Ogden makes a desperate gesture to lift Kitty out of depression. He buys a mansion on a tiny island in Maine. It's there the Miltons and their descendants will summer for decades to come. And it's there that most, but not all, of the Miltons will fine-tune the WASP practice of shrouding tragedy and secrets in silence. Blake is an accomplished storyteller, braiding in a large cast of characters and colorful excursions to places like pre-World War II Germany and 1950s Greenwich Village. She's also hip to the fact that this kind of lush historical novel, tied to the annual visits of a wealthy clan gathering to crack lobster tails by the sea, absolutely reeks of off-putting privilege and literary mothballs. No matter, the Guest Book proudly owns the appeal of an old-fashioned sweeping storyline, and in so doing, complicates many of its characters beyond the shallow first impressions they make. In fact, one of the most engaging characters here defends the essential human yearning for a good story. Kitty's granddaughter, Evie, is a professor of feminist medieval history. A postmodernist, Evie knows better than to believe that the past has a plot. And yet, she admits to herself that she longs against reason for the promise of a pattern, for the relief, the unbearable relief of an omniscient narrator. The Guest Book offers that relief and much more. If The Guest Book is a kind of Victorian novel with a gloss of contemporary self-consciousness, The Last, by British author Hannah Jameson, is an unusual thriller in which Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None collides with Stephen King's The Shining and Neville Shute's apocalyptic chestnut On the Beach. The premise alone is golden. an historian named John Keller, is attending a conference at a grand but remote hotel in Switzerland when the world ends. According to news reports that quickly peter out, a nuclear holocaust has wiped out Washington, New York, Berlin, and on. The 20 survivors left in the hotel after others have taken off debate the wisdom of walking to faraway Zurich or staying put and waiting for the nuclear cloud. When the water in the hotel begins to taste funky, John and some other guests climb to the roof to investigate the water towers. In one, they find the corpse of a young girl who's been murdered. The last raises the moral question of whether one isolated murder would still matter, given what appears to be the erasure of most of the people on the planet. Jameson presents her story in the form of a diary that John writes, so there's a "you are there" vividness to the events. Here, for instance, is an entry from day 27 of John's stay in post-apocalyptic limbo. "I'm sure I heard guitar music last night. I went for a walk, which was terrifying, even by candlelight, and tried to locate the room it was coming from, but I couldn't find it. 14 floors, almost 1,000 rooms, and I didn't see or hear a single person." Like the guest book, The Last tells a story readers will get lost in. But it's also a story you'll be very relieved to escape from.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Guest Book by Sarah Black and The Last by Hannah Jameson. On Monday's Fresh Air, why would anyone want to revisit the awkwardness of their middle school years? We talk with Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle, who do just that in their Hulu series Pen 15, which they created and in which they star. Also, John and Molly Chester tell us about creating an environmentally sustainable farm, the subject of their documentary, The Biggest Little Farm. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.B. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inclusive.